Hey, this is Richard Deitch, the host of the Sports Media Podcast. If you're interested in what's happening with all the places where you consume sports, the Sports Media Podcast has you covered.
I've been turning down interviews all week. Hoda Kotb reached out, Oprah, George Stephanopoulos. So I said no. I was booked on the Deitch Podcast before the Taylor Swift phenomenon. I must live up to my responsibility.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, folks. June 30th. Hope you're having a great Tuesday morning. We've got a great lineup for you today. Glade Bilby, president of the French Quarter Citizens and co-chair of Save Our Soul Coalition Armstrong Park Community Group. He's also the commissioner of the French Quarter Management Commission. We'll talk about the Lower Decatur Street businesses saying months of construction delays are threatening their survival, with some iconic establishments already closing. Is relief on the way, or is the damage already done? There's been a lawsuit filed by a number of the businesses wanting to try and speed up this process, get it over with, so that by August, September, when we get back into the convention season, maybe they can get their life back together. Jeanette Weiland, LSU New Orleans interim chancellor and chief administrative officer, tomorrow, July 1st, will be the day that officially LSU New Orleans joins the LSU system. We'll discuss what this transition means for students, faculties, the New Orleans community, and the future of higher education in the region. NOLA Coalition segment, we'll visit with Greg Rusevich. He's the chair of the Metro Crime Commission, past chair of New Orleans Crime Coalition. We'll talk about the French Quarter getting a high-tech crime-fighting upgrade. A new 24/7 drone as a first responder, and what that will mean in the French Quarter. At 10:30, Kent Lassman, Competitive Enterprise Institute president. In a 6-3 decision yesterday, the Supreme Court held that statutory restrictions on the president's authority to remove Federal Trade Commission commissioners violates the separation of powers principles, which overrules Humphrey's Executive versus United States, 295 U.S. 602 in 1935, in restoring executive accountability over officers who exercise executive power. And he'll weigh in on their take on this decision. So we're celebrating the 250th birthday of this country. Well, what marks that day? July 4th, 1776. The unanimous declaration of 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to this separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, It is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security, such as been the patient sufferance of these colonies. And such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called another legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise. The state, remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone, for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, given his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures, and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coast, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to follow themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice, magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of our consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That's what we celebrate, 250 years, going back to the Declaration of Independence adopted in Congress on July 4th, 1776. We'll be
right back. Hey there, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and your money is going to move. We're going to help you make better financial decisions. We're going to call out the BS you're finding all over social media. We're going to give you actionable guidance to make your financial life clearer, less stressful. We're going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen to Money Moves with Jill Schlesinger wherever you get your podcasts.
Right back. I hope you enjoyed the reading of the Declaration of Independence. We'll read passages of the U.S. Constitution during this week as we celebrate our 250th anniversary. The brilliance of the forefathers of this country. I spent this past weekend reading about half of the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton addressing the people in New York. If you want to get a greater understanding of the brilliance of the forefathers of this country, read the Federalist Papers. They are absolutely incredible. They remind you so much of what this country stands for. We are joined by Kent Lastman, Competitive Enterprise Institute president, to talk about a most recent Supreme Court ruling handed down yesterday, Trump versus Slaughter, that seems to finally, hopefully maybe, put to rest just what the authority is, whoever it is that sits as the head of the executive department, the president of the United States. Kent, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Newell. I'm happy to be with you.
So, Ken, I know you guys were involved in helping litigate some of these cases and the history of these cases. If you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, could you give us a synopsis of how we got to where we were yesterday in the release of that Trump versus Slaughter decision?
Well, the recent history depends on your frame of reference, right? It goes back to a decision from the New Deal in 1935. There was a dispute between a deceased member, the estate of a deceased member of the Federal Trade Commission, and the Franklin Roosevelt administration. And it had to do with who's in charge of the removal of a commissioner. This is an agency that had been set up in 1914 with the express purpose, written right into the law, of being independent from politics. And this rule said that the president, coming out of the Supreme Court in a case called Humphrey's Executor, the president could not remove a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commissioner without cause. And the standard was vague, but nonetheless, there was a standard there that you had to show that they were doing something really wrong. And that started to come undone with legal scholarship in the 80s, and ultimately a case that we brought here at the Competitive Enterprise Institute against a different agency that went to the Supreme Court in 2010. So we're still talking almost a generation ago, 16 years ago, and that was a case called Free Enterprise Fund versus PCAOB. And the Public Accounting Board, which is a product of the regulatory state coming out of the financial crisis, had a two-tier system for removal. First, a member of the PCAOB had to be found to be removed by the Securities and Exchange Commission and then by the president. And the court said, you can't have a two-tier system. Fast forward a decade, 2020, we had a similar case come forward called Celia Law. And there it was about the Consumer Financial Protection Board. In each of these cases, the Federal Trade Commission, PCAOB, the CFPB, these are agencies that are called independent agencies. And I use that with sort of air quotes or scare quotes. And Celia Law found that the president could not be limited for an agency that was designed with a single head. But the court didn't say anything about agencies like the FTC that had five commissioners, or the PCAOB. So that brings us to the present day. And finally, after 91 years, this affront to the Constitution from Humphrey's Executor was repealed yesterday. And the court said, we just can't put conditions on the authority of the chief executive, our president, from removing people who work in his or her administration. And that's the big finding yesterday. And like I said, it brings us back to our constitutional bearings that we had from the founding right up through the New Deal.
It seems as though, and I think y'all appropriately pointed out, that how do you ever achieve accountability? I mean, somebody runs for office, they have a platform, they talk about the things necessary to do, in their view, to improve upon our country, whether it's an economic issue, a social issue, or otherwise. You have the deep state, a bunch of different agencies that didn't even exist back when some of these seminal cases were decided, and that really just go on and on and on, and almost in an alternative world to what the president is talking about, the platform that he or she may have, and what the people voted for when they put them in office. They get in office and they're basically, I guess, impotent in many respects, right?
That's right. The idea of the central idea, you were talking about the Federalist Papers and the brilliance of the debates that took place at our founding that so many people are rediscovering this summer. the central idea that would protect regular people, that would protect our liberties, is the separation of powers. And the way to execute, to implement, to operationalize a separation of powers is democratic accountability, or going to the ballot box. So when you have all of these hundreds of regulatory agencies that can make rules that have the force of law, and there is no democratic accountability, that means we are somehow erasing, smudging the lines about that separation of powers that provides for our essential protection. And like I said, what we have here is a movement back to the constitutional order. And ultimately, this is just a really great development, because it shows that if you're going to be the manager, we will allow for complications or blending of power and authority for the naming of an administrator, which is to say the president picks a person and the Senate provides consent. But if you're going to manage that person and hold them accountable to a program, you have to be able to remove them. You have to be able to say, you're on the wrong page, you're doing the wrong things, this is not what the electorate voted for.
Yeah, it's amazing that this has gone on for so many years, that the head of an organization, the administrator of an organization, can be at cross purposes with their boss. I mean, and you don't see that anywhere else, right?
I was just going to say, any job that I've ever had, you get at cross purposes with your boss at your own peril. Now, you can go to your boss and say, I think we should do this thing instead of that thing over there. But ultimately, they're the boss. And the federal government was an exception here, and bringing us back in line where the president has the authority to effectively remove these regulators means every future president has the ability to manage the regulatory state. And that way we hold, whether we like or dislike what's happening through regulation, we can hold the president accountable.
And you've seen this, and if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, some of the regulatory provisions that have come out of these agencies are, how do I describe them? I mean, so picayune-ish. They become a collection of just overbearing mandates that make accomplishing much of anything, in some cases, in some realms, almost impossible, right? Or is that an overstatement?
I think it's fair. It's a fair statement. To really give it meat, we can unpack it a little bit. Again, going back to these founding documents that you've been sharing with your audience, that you've been re-examining yourself, the notion that we have is that in order to create a just society, a fair society, a place where people all have a chance to get ahead and pursue their own life in their own way, right? You don't have to be told what profession to go into. In that sort of situation, we want to create what are called laws of general applicability, or if a law applies, it applies to everyone equally. We don't want to see special punishments or restrictions on one person or one community or one type of company. And the further we go into regulatory lawmaking, the further we go, it's a direct connection, the further we go into specialized laws for, and it gives the regulators the power to nitpick and to handpick who will be the winner and who will be the loser in a given industry, who has the opportunity to be an innovator and who does not have an opportunity to even get into the market. And that's why it's so important to focus our attention not just on the big national debates on Capitol Hill or with what happens at the White House, but to really roll back this regulatory state that's been put in place during the last century so that we can have rules that apply to everyone equally, as opposed to specialized narrow nitpicking rules.
Of course, with that, for the executive branch, the head, the president, comes a responsibility, in my view, and sometimes we hit the mark and other times we really don't, where we put people in positions that have never run anything, never have been involved in the particular discipline that they're being asked to run. They don't have any particular expertise. And I think that's where a lot of the skepticism comes out in the public about, and some are even protective of the deep state for that very reason, because we take a very cavalier approach to these positions and who we appoint to them. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's two extremes that we want to navigate between as a country. On one extreme, we have a terrible patronage system like we saw immediately after the War of 1812, after the Civil War, where people with no credentials, no expertise, and oftentimes no interest in even doing the job are given jobs and put on the payroll. That leads to all sorts of corruption and cronyism and bad outcomes. And people don't get the services, whether it's the roads don't get built or whatnot, that they expect from their government. On the other hand, we also don't want, as you said, a deep state, a set of agencies. We have some 460 plus agencies that can create rules that are untouchable. And they operate outside of the Congress and outside of the White House. That is not good either. And so ping-ponging between them is one strategy, I think unhealthy. But a smarter way to do it is to write relatively narrow laws that don't give too much discretion to the agencies. The discretion is actually debated in the Congress. And then appointing people of merit and asking them to do the work. That's not something that we've seen in the modern era, but I'll tell you, it's the direction that we're headed.
Hopefully so. I'm not sure I'm as optimistic as you are, and I'll say that based on one premise. Our Congress, in my view, is getting more lazy, not less lazy. They're just so willing to give their authority away to everybody out there. We have a full-time Congress. We involve ourselves in things, and I think you would agree with this, on issues that why are we wasting our time on this issue? What are we doing here? There's so many, many more important issues that need to be resolved, that are unresolved, that are really standing in the way of progress. Let's focus on that. Let's figure that out and let's move on. When you think about the most recent Supreme Court decisions that are coming out, a lot of these decisions are stimulated by the fact that Congress has been sitting on their hands doing nothing for a long time. Your thoughts?
I agree with you. I get to a slightly different conclusion, but I agree with you. Everything that you're saying there. I remember the words of the great Herb Stein once observed, something that can't go on forever won't. And everything you described is true. For more than a generation now, Congress has slowly, to everyone's surprise, certainly the surprise of James Madison, he wrote directly on this question, the United States Congress has willingly given up its own authority. No one ever expected that. As Madison said, we should expect them to jealously guard their prerogatives. Mm-hmm. Now, that has happened, and that has been a trend. But like Herb Stein said, it can't go on forever. And whether it's on major questions doctrine, the question that was presented and adjudicated yesterday with the holding in Trump v. Slaughter that I talked about with the hiring and firing of regulators, whether it's delegation questions. These sorts of court decisions that we've started to see in the last half dozen years are a product of the Congress failing to do its job. And every time, including last night and this morning, we will see members of Congress, famous people, people that, whose names you recognize from the newspaper, they jump up and down and holler and talk about the Supreme Court, you know, doing something bad, when we know that they have in their own power the remedy. They can write better laws. They can write laws that actually address the problems of the day and not just what they call messaging bills, where they're trying to create a campaign issue. And I think that's absolutely accurate what you said, that the Congress has lost its muscle memory on how to do the good work that Congress is called to do. But I don't think that will go on forever. And in fact, with the court finding its way back to our constitutional foundations, they're not going to be able to.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But they're not the only ones that are lazy, and I think you would probably agree with me as well. I mean, the electorate in this country, it mystifies me. I just don't understand why people don't hold that privilege and that right of voting and really setting the course of their future, that they don't hold it up as a principle, a top-of-mind issue for them. We had a U.S. Senate race here in Louisiana this past weekend, 17% turnout. I mean, it's abysmal, you know, and when you look at some of the most recent polling, I think Eton University did a YouGov poll recently about how proud we are of whether or not we feel like, you know, our democracy here is working, is sound. A huge difference of opinion in this country right now over that issue. And it's interesting because in my mind, the electorate is the one that holds the power. If we want it to change, we hold the power to change it. It's one of the reasons I read the Declaration of Independence this morning. I mean, you know, it was, a document of grievances. And they said, we're not putting up with this anymore. We're changing. We're going to do something different.
You know, it's really remarkable the lessons that can come from a study of history. It doesn't even have to be a particularly close study of history, but whether it's the American founding, the temperance movement, the suffrage movement, civil rights in this country, the abolition movement, which was driven by 2.5 generations of work, each of these renewals came about when people started to recognize that the individual had the authority to get together with their neighbors and friends, that people as individuals thought, I can do something about this. And that is a spark that I think cannot go out. And when it comes to voting and it comes to selecting good candidates who will do the job that we send up to Congress to do, I remain confident. I understand your skepticism. It can look dark before the dawn, but I'm excited about what's in front of us.
Well, Kent Lastman, I completely embrace what you just said. Well said. I hope to be the glass half full person soon.
Very good. We'll sit down together and have a glass.
More than one, my friend. Kent Lastman, president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed the conversation, and have a great celebration this weekend.
Likewise to you and all your listeners.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, you'll hear true stories that will intrigue you, inspire you, and make you laugh.
He said, is there anything in your diet that might be spiking your blood sugar? I said, sometimes I eat pizza until I'm unconscious. He said, I think that might be it.
For real stories live on stage from comedians, astronauts, accountants, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
So there's a whole bunch of Supreme Court decisions that rolled out today. I think there were four, which were the final court decisions that were announced. And we'll probably break those down again tomorrow once we're able to read through those decisions. There seems to be a lot of concurring, but for different reasons in some of the decisions. It looks as though on the biological sex issue and eligibility for sports the court has ruled that the states and schools can determine eligibility on their own. It's not a sweeping decision that holds all states and all schools in the country to this one standard, but it's not unconstitutional to say that biological men cannot participate in female sports, which is a win. And in Title IX, one that I have been very adamant about and very vocal about since its very beginning. I took a lot of grief early onset. I competed from a young age in a sport, and I knew that in that particular sport, swimming, that it was going to be an issue that would reveal itself probably sooner than in most other states, and it did. And I understand the sacrifices that young boys and girls make over the years to compete at a high level. And I just found that it was fundamentally unfair that one could switch and call oneself something and decide to go compete against a different sex. And that wasn't the case in all cases, but it was an example of how egregious the state of the situation was and how unfair it was to female athletes, and obviously a slap in the face to Title IX. It looks as though this is going down a road, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out from an implementation standpoint in all of the respective states. This state, thankfully, has, I think, been on the right side of the issue. Many other states have been on the right side of the issue as well, and we will see where this ends up on a state-by-state basis. A number of the athletic associations, to include the NCAA, have already opined on that and have already ruled that biological men cannot compete in female sports. And we potentially will see more. Maybe some of the high school athletic associations and others that have been a little leery and hesitant to involve oneself for fear of litigation, because this has been an issue that's been incredibly litigious. And hopefully this helps facilitate those that want to make, in my view, my opinion, the right decision on this issue. But we'll see. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. When the storm hits and your power goes out, don't you want to feel confident that your home and family will be okay? Don't get caught in the heat and the dark this summer. Win backup power from WWL and Craig's Electrical and Generator Service. We're giving away a Generac GP6500 portable generator, a nearly $1,000 value right now. Enter at WWL.com/contest. Win peace of mind from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, just like last month's winner, Francis Honey Pearson of Madisonville, because when the power goes off, Craig comes on with WWL. And also, folks, just a reminder, we have tickets to New Orleans Beatle Fest, and we want you to be there. Listen to Scoop between 1 and 4 p.m. every day this week when he plays the Beatles song of the day. Go to WWL.com/contest and register to win a family four-pack. And remember, you need to know the song Scoot played to enter. Win tickets to Beatle Fest Saturday, July 11th at the Jefferson Performing Arts Center. And good luck from WWL. All right, folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with in our NOLA Coalition segment with Greg Rusevich, chair of the Metro Crime Commission, past chair of the New Orleans Crime Coalition. We're going to talk about some high-tech crime fighting upgrades to be made in the French Quarter, a new 24/7 drone as a first responder. The program is getting closer to the launch. Officials just approved a final budget, and they're ready to move forward, which is good news. We'll talk about that and some other pressing issues as well that are lurking out there at the present time. And on a text line, folks, kicking down on transgender Louisiana. Louisiana has never had a high school transgender athlete, not one. Well, this isn't just about Louisiana, and I think that you're incorrect in that. But be that as it may, this is about competition in this country. And there's been, I think there's 29,000 identified transgender high school athletes that exist today, right now. So this is not a topic that's going away.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.